Habsburg lands and the Empire. The rapid accumulation of dynastic possessions between 1477 and 1526 did not expand the empire. Those lands already within the empire remained so: Burgundy, Milan, Bohemia. Those outside were not incorporated within imperial jurisdiction: Hungary, Spain, Sicily, Naples. Meanwhile, Habsburg possessions within the empire were grouped separately into the Austrian and Burgundian Kreise in 1512, while Bohemia was omitted entirely from the new regional structure. The princes had insisted on incorporation, hoping to extend scrutiny and control over the financial and military contributions from the Habsburg lands through the new common structures. The Habsburg lands always contributed the lion's share, far in excess of their formal assessments. But Maximilian I and his successors were determined not to allow the princes to direct how they spent their own subjects' money. Over time, the Habsburgs came to appreciate the benefits of having incorporated their Austrian and Burgundian lands within the Kreise, since this allowed them to engage in regional politics as imperial estates as well as emperor. After 1558, it also allowed the Austrian branch to retain a hold over Burgundy, despite Charles V assigning it to Spain in 1548. Charles had agreed that Burgundy should pay double tax rates, triple if assisting against the Turks, and Spain initially honored this, though it paid Austria directly rather than remitting the money through the Reichspfennigmeister. Austria's refusal to treat the Dutch revolt after 1566 as a breach of the public peace soured relations and led to Spain suspending further payments. Nonetheless, Spain also appreciated the utility of retaining its Burgundian territories as part of the empire, since this allowed it to act as an imperial estate rather than a foreign power. Spanish intervention in support of Austria during the Thirty Years' War was presented this way to undercut anti-Habsburg Protestant propaganda. Both Burgundy and Austria only existed as Kreise on paper. Neither held an assembly, despite both containing a few minor non-Habsburg members. Meanwhile, the imperial police ordinances of 1530 and 1548 exempted Austria from a wide range of laws passed by the Reichstag. The Imperial Currency Ordinance of 1559 granted similar exemptions, while Habsburg subjects were prevented from appealing cases to the Imperial Supreme Courts after 1637. The Peace of Westphalia allowed the Habsburgs to claim all their possessions as officially Catholic, denying their still substantial Protestant minority the rights granted minorities elsewhere by that treaty, except for six peace churches established in Silesia. Although they isolated their lands, the Habsburgs still needed to deal with the rest of the empire to foster legitimacy and solicit aid. Traditional methods were employed alongside the new institutions developing across the era of imperial reform. Swabia emerged as the area closest to the king during the late 15th century, because this region was next to the Habsburgs' original possessions in Alsace and around the Black Forest. Dealings with Swabia showed how the family skillfully employed the opportunities offered by the lengthening status hierarchy. As local lords themselves, the Habsburgs deliberately engaged with their neighbors more as equals to win their cooperation through the Swabian League, founded in 1488, which constituted the cornerstone of what has been termed the Maximilian system. Their methods show how the empire's internal structure was still fluid at this point. Frederick III and Maximilian I not only negotiated with those lords and cities who were being invited to the new Reichstag, but also with mediate nobles and towns in the process of forming assemblies, Landstände, in territories that themselves were still taking shape. Although they preferred to cooperate with senior nobles, both emperors were prepared to work with burghers where necessary and offered cash, privileges, appointments, and favorable judicial verdicts to cultivate useful clients. These methods worked best where the emperor could appeal to a broad cross-section of inhabitants, as in the southwest. But they were harder to employ in regions physically further from Habsburg possessions, which were also usually those with fewer lordships or inhabitants. The development of the Kreiser gave the imperial estates an alternative framework for regional cooperation, independent of the emperor. Nonetheless, the Habsburgs continued to see a league as a way to forge binding ties to imperial estates outside the increasingly formalized imperial institutions. This became harder following the Reformation, when Lutheran princes and cities combined in the Schmalkaldic League to demand religious autonomy, thereby hastening the demise of the pro-imperial Swabian League, which failed to renew its charter in 1534. Charles's victory over the Schmalkaldic League in 1547 at the Battle of Mühlberg appeared to offer an opportunity for him to attempt a significant reorganization of imperial governance at the Armored Reichstag in Augsburg the following year. Milan and the western Habsburg possessions were transferred to Spain under the Burgundian Treaty. Meanwhile, Ferdinand remained responsible for Austria, Bohemia, and Hungary. All princely alliances were formally annulled, except the defunct Swabian League, which was revived as a new imperial league, Reichsbund, intended to bind the imperial estates to the Habsburgs. All imperial estates were now to pay funds into a central imperial military chest to support an army under Habsburg control. Rather than centralizing the empire, these measures were intended to provide a clearer division of responsibility, with Ferdinand and Charles's son Philip looking after the two blocks of Habsburg territory, while the German lands were grouped within the League to manage them more easily. All three elements remained under Charles's suzerainty as emperor. The scheme failed because Charles tried to move too far, too fast. By trying to include all electors in his new league, Charles allowed them to combine against it, using the Reichstag, which was now too well established to be ignored. Charles's decision to push the measures in person at the Armored Reichstag made it difficult to compromise without losing prestige. Resistance gathered into the Prince's Revolt of 1552, forcing the Habsburgs not only to abandon the Imperial League, but eventually to agree the religious peace of Augsburg in 1555. This outcome exposed the difficulties of managing such an extensive collection of lands, prompting Charles to partition Habsburg possessions through a series of measures between 1556 and 1558. Whereas Frankish nobles retained a sense of a wider empire after the partition in the Treaty of Verdun, 843, the connections after 1558 were now only dynastic, with the two Habsburg branches considering themselves a common Casa d'Austria. Spain was imperial through its extensive possessions stretching to the New World, while Austria owed its status to retaining the imperial title in the person of Ferdinand I. Ferdinand also tried to manage the German lands through a pro-imperial league called the Landsberg Alliance. Formed in 1556, this persisted until 1598, but never included more than 9 imperial estates confined to the southeast. The League's significance lay in its deliberately cross-confessional membership of both Protestants and Catholics. By leading it, Ferdinand signaled the future direction of Habsburg imperial governance. The family justified its continued hold on the imperial title by presenting itself as trustworthy guardian of the common good and the empire's internal peace and external security. Ferdinand and his three immediate successors now accepted the Reichstag as the primary forum to negotiate with the imperial estates, securing substantial financial backing by holding 12 Reichstags between 1556 and 1613. However, The sheer number of imperial estates complicated the process of finding a consensus, encouraging a parallel trend to consult the electors, either ahead of a Reichstag or instead of it, as occurred during Ferdinand II's reign. Charles V's unprecedented abdication on the 3rd of August 1556 greatly enhanced the electors' influence, since Ferdinand I depended on their continued support to secure the imperial title ahead of his elder brother's actual death in September 1558. Ferdinand won them over by opposing Charles's plan to make the title hereditary and by confirming their right of self-assembly. Cooperation continued despite the conversion of the Elector Palatine to Calvinism around 1560. The electors accepted Ferdinand I's son Maximilian II and grandson Rudolf II as kings of the Romans in 1562 and 1575 respectively, on each occasion ensuring the seamless continuity of Habsburg imperial rule. Imperial governance during the Thirty Years' War. Rudolf II's refusal to marry precipitated a succession crisis that deepened with the Habsburgs' financial and political bankruptcy following the Long Turkish War, 1593 to 1606. Unlike the previous deposition of Wenzel in 1400, orchestrated by the electors, the Habsburgs kept their problems to themselves. Spain backed Matthias as a safer pair of hands than the depressive and reclusive Rudolf. Matthias's attempt to force Rudolf to transfer power triggered the brothers' quarrel after 1608, which saw both make damaging concessions to the Protestant nobles who dominated their provincial estates. By May 1611, Rudolf had been deprived of all Habsburg lands and remained under virtual house arrest in his castle in Prague. His death in 1612 allowed Matthias to secure election as emperor, but he was himself childless and ill, and the whole episode seriously damaged Habsburg prestige and influence. As we have heard, the distraction created a partial political vacuum in the German lands that was filled by the Protestant Union and Catholic League, formed respectively in 1608 and 1609 by the rival Wittelsbach branches of the Palatinate and Bavaria. By 1617, Matthias had neutralized the League by compelling Bavaria to admit new members, rendering the organization no longer suitable as a vehicle for its own interests. Meanwhile, the Palatinate's deliberate disruption of the Reichstag in 1608 encouraged the trend to consult only the three ecclesiastical electors, Cologne, Mainz, and Trier, and the generally pro-imperial Saxony. The group widened to include Bavaria once that prince received the Palatine lands and electoral title in 1623 as a reward for helping to crush the Bohemian Revolt, 1618 to 1620, at the start of the Thirty Years' War. Electoral congresses convened in 1627, 1630, and 1636 to 1637. Saxony temporarily defected to the Swedes between 1631 and 1634 to pressure Ferdinand II into reversing his ill-judged edict of restitution. Although limited, Ferdinand's concessions were sufficient to entice Saxony back in the Peace of Prague in May 1635. Saxony was allowed to annex the former Habsburg provinces of Upper and Lower Lusatia, which it had occupied since 1620, as a pledge that the cash-strapped Habsburgs would refund the cost of its military assistance in crushing the Bohemian Revolt. In return, it accepted Ferdinand's interpretation of the war as a rebellion, thereby legitimating his expropriation of his opponent's lands and titles whenever he could defeat them, like the Palatinate. Whereas the religious peace of Augsburg had been negotiated openly at a Reichstag, the Peace of Prague was agreed between Saxony and the Emperor, and then presented to the imperial estates, who could only accept or reject it. Only Bavaria, and to a lesser extent, Cologne and Brandenburg, were able to negotiate special concessions. The exclusion of the lesser imperial estates fueled their sense of disenfranchisement. Already, many minor lords and cities had joined the Protestant Union and Catholic League because they believed the existing institutions no longer guaranteed their autonomy amidst the political and confessional tension. The Palatinate especially had played on their resentment, presenting a more aristocratic interpretation of the Constitution in the guise of religious parity, since meeting in two confessional corpora offered to level the Reichstag's hierarchy of three colleges, electors, princes, and imperial cities. Ferdinand III addressed these concerns after his accession in 1637, in the hope of rallying broad support to end the Thirty Years' War on the basis of the Peace of Prague. He held the first Reichstag for 27 years in Regensburg between 1640 and 1641, restoring some trust in Habsburg leadership despite the deteriorating military situation now that France had intervened to support Sweden, while Spain was no longer able to assist Austria. Ferdinand's move inhibited the formation of a clear anti-Habsburg bloc among the imperial estates, despite the willingness of France and Sweden to support constitutional changes that would indeed have converted the empire into something more resembling an aristocracy. He avoided his father's mistake at the Peace of Prague and invited all imperial estates to the Westphalian Peace Congress in 1645, rallying most of them to block the more radical revisions proposed by France and Sweden. Stabilization of the Empire, 1648 to 1658. The Peace of Westphalia of 1648 is usually seen as one of the greatest catastrophes in German history. Supposedly, the empire was reduced to a loose federation under the emperor's nominal presidency, emancipating the principalities from the constitution, now allegedly preserved in aspic. The terms referred to territorial rights, jus territorii, and alliance rights, jus federa, but did not in fact grant new powers. Exercise of such rights remained curtailed by imperial law and duty to the empire, as had been the case before 1618. Awkward constitutional questions were simply postponed until the next Reichstag. Imperial prerogatives remained broadly intact, though the exercise of some of them now clearly depended on consultation through the Reichstag. The repeated reference throughout the treaty to imperial estates further eroded the personal character of imperial politics, best symbolized by the prince's loss of their earlier right since Augsburg in 1555 to change their subject's religion, which was now fixed by identifying each territory as officially either Protestant or Catholic. The presence of France and Sweden as foreign guarantors was probably the least significant of the main set of changes. Saxony, Bavaria, and above all Brandenburg obtained additional land at a point when the war had demonstrated the military potential of the larger territories. The Habsburgs secured their core goals, including acceptance of the sweeping redistribution of private property within Austria and Bohemia in the 1620s, which rebalanced the Habsburg monarchy as an alliance between the ruling dynasty and major aristocratic landowners. The consolidation of Habsburg power preserved the empire as a hierarchy, since no other prince was able to challenge their leadership. Likewise, the electors combined to ensure their continued preeminence over the other princes, regardless of the actual distribution of material resources. Austrian policy after 1648 was preoccupied with retaining the imperial title and asserting claims to the Spanish succession, given the increasing likelihood of that branch's extinction, which grew after the accession of the childless and feeble-minded Charles II in 1665. Engagement with the empire was necessary to both goals, especially as acquisition of Spain's Italian lands was prioritized. Ferdinand carefully cultivated broad support amongst the imperial estates, securing the election of his son Ferdinand IV as King of the Romans. Ferdinand III staged a lavish entry into Regensburg in 1653 for his son's coronation and the opening of a new Reichstag amidst fireworks and opera performances, all demonstrating his family's continued power despite the recent harrowing war. Additional limits were placed on his ability to create new princes, but more radical attempts to revise the constitution were defeated, and Ferdinand won new support from North German Protestant territories, alarmed by Sweden's ambitions in their region. Imperial politics remained open, with various routes for the emperor and imperial estates to achieve their goals. These options gradually narrowed after the early 1680s, without the constitution ever reaching total gridlock. A sense of uncertainty continued with the Franco-Spanish War, which only ended in 1659, as well as Ferdinand IV's death at just 20 in July 1654, followed by that of his father, aged only 48, in April 1657. Ferdinand III had not had sufficient time to secure the election of his second son, Leopold I, as King of the Romans, leading to an interregnum prolonged to 14 months by French interference. The electors not only rejected Louis XIV's candidacy, but refrained from imposing anything more than minor additional restrictions on imperial prerogatives in return for electing Leopold in July 1658. The Permanent Reichstag. Leopold was only 18 when elected emperor, and what proved to be his longevity, 1658 to 1705, gave the Habsburgs the stability they needed to achieve their objectives. Crucial to Leopold's success was his willingness to work within rather than against the post-1648 constitutional order. Various attempts to negotiate with the electors and a small imperial deputation failed to resolve outstanding security and reform questions, obliging Leopold to summon a new Reichstag when confronted with a Turkish attack on Hungary in 1662. Having opened on the 20th of January 1663, the Reichstag remained permanently in session until the end of the empire. This was not planned. There were four serious attempts to wind it up before 1741. While no formal sessions were held during 1692 to 1697, 1747 to 1750, and 1780 to 1785, due to political tensions, notably Austro-Prussian rivalry. Nonetheless, the Reichstag's permanence exceeded the annual meetings agreed in 1495, and also began much earlier than Britain's Mother of Parliaments, which only became permanent after 1717. England's Triennial Act, 1694, restricted each parliament to no more than 3 years, because a permanent assembly was regarded like a standing army, as a mark of tyranny. This pinpoints the key distinction between Britain's parliament and the empire's Reichstag. British parliamentarians were representatives elected by enfranchised inhabitants, who would lose their rights and influence if the same people remained MPs indefinitely. The Reichstag was not a parliament, because it represented the imperial estates, not their populations. There was no prospect of its evolving into a democratic institution without fundamentally altering the empire's character as a mixed monarchy and enfranchising inhabitants rather than territories. The Reichstag remained permanent simply because it proved the most effective forum within which all imperial estates and the emperor could negotiate, thereby rendering most other consultative institutions redundant. This set the basic pattern for Habsburg imperial governance until 1806. The emperor would seek formal ratification for important measures like declarations of war by negotiating with the Reichstag and, in many cases, also the Kreis assemblies, especially those in the south and west that enabled him to contact numerous smaller territories. Meanwhile, more informal channels were used to achieve more localized goals, or to speed up formal ratification by negotiating directly with influential individual imperial estates through envoys or correspondence. Bilateral and occasionally multilateral alliances were forged with princes, usually to secure additional military support above official obligations. These methods further eroded the personal element in imperial politics, which increasingly assumed the character of multiple written agreements between its different actors. Politics remained asymmetrical, rather than equal, as we would have expected if the empire had truly become a federation after 1648. Princes appeared as petitioners, seeking the emperor's backing for an elevated status for themselves, their morganatic wives or mistresses, or revisions to their territory's formal position within the empire, or other benefits like favorable verdicts in disputes with their neighbors. The goals of princes thus remained specific, and they did not seek generalized constitutional change. Indeed, they often protested when other princes received the same kind of favors they sought themselves. Participation in wider European warfare was generally driven by similar desires. Princes overwhelmingly sought connections with other states that were already the emperor's allies, like Britain and the Dutch Republic, in the hope these would pressure him on their behalf. Although the Habsburgs occupied the position of strength, theirs was a difficult hand to play. They remained perennially short of money, and were often unable to pay for the additional military assistance that princes provided. More importantly, the reservoir of desirable honors in their gift was finite. Minor ennoblements and local political backing cost the Habsburgs little, but direct interference in imperial justice risked undermining their prestige and, ultimately, their ability to manage the empire. Habsburg support was usually limited to applying pressure on the parties involved to reach the desired settlement. Significant status elevations were harder to achieve after 1654, when they needed the Reichstag's agreement. Leopold became adept at dangling promises that were rarely delivered, at least not in full. He secured the election of his eldest son, Joseph I, as King of the Romans in January 1690, safeguarding the continuity of Habsburg rule. The election was actively promoted by the Archbishop of Mainz, who appeared with five other electors in person to cast unanimous votes. This was a strong endorsement of Habsburg rule amidst a two-front war against both France and the Ottomans. However, the constant conflicts after 1672 accelerated the internationalization of imperial politics by widening the number of European powers keen to hire German auxiliaries. France was prepared to pay handsomely for key princes to refrain from participating in imperial defense, adding to the pressure on Leopold as the Spanish succession loomed in the 1690s. He was forced to deliver on promises and elevate the Duke of Calenberg, Hanover, to electoral status in 1692, intensifying competition amongst the other old princely houses. Savoy had to be granted Grand Ducal status in 1696, while Austria assisted the Saxon Elector, whom the Poles chose as their king the following year. Finally, and fatefully, Leopold agreed to recognize the Brandenburg Elector as King in Prussia in November 1700 in return for military backing in what became the War of the Spanish Succession within a few months. Each time, he alienated other Habsburg clients and stoked problems for the future. Collective action. Imperial taxation. Wars such as that over the Spanish succession required a level of resource mobilization far in excess of anything undertaken by the medieval empire. The overall size of European armies rose by 1,000% across the 16th to 18th centuries, or more than 3 times the rate of population growth. Contrary to the received view, the empire responded quite effectively to this challenge. This is not obvious from the level of revenue accruing from imperial prerogatives, which remained minimal after Charles IV's dissipation of the crown lands in the late 14th century, and despite efforts to revive income during the early 18th century. After the initial problems with the common penny to fund the Reichskammergericht, the 1507 Reichstag introduced a new tax, called the Zehler, because it was held to be paid in 2 annual installments, timed to coincide with the Frankfurt Zehlen, or spring and autumn trade fairs. The imperial estates were assigned quotas, but they were left to themselves how to find the money. Many fell into arrears, but the problem was magnified by the practice throughout the empire's population of recording debts long after any realistic prospect of payment. Tax rates were raised in 1720 when the salaries of judges and staff were doubled as part of a wider reform of the court's administration. The official annual total of the Zehler was now 120,000 florins, or 25% above what was required for salaries. Receipts varied between 78,000 and 139,500 florins annually from 1742 to 1770. Another reform increased the Zehler again in 1776, and within 6 years, the tax was running a healthy surplus, while Brandenburg, which had not paid anything since 1713, resumed payments after 1790 and soon cleared its entire arrears. Far more money was raised on an ad hoc basis for defense using the matricula system introduced by imperial reform. The system could be used to levy troops and/or their cash equivalents, which had been calculated since 1521 using a unit of account called a Roman month, RM, based on the paybill of the armed escort envisaged for Charles V's coronation journey. The nominal value of an RM was reckoned initially at 128,000 florins, but it had already fallen to 68,700 florins by 1576, and to around 50,000 by the 18th century. Like the Zehler arrears, these reductions reflect flaws in how assessments were assigned. Several imperial estates already protested in 1524 at their assessments, eventually securing revisions for the period 1545 to 1551 that collectively reduced the official RM by 6%. Further problems crept in as some territories received temporary remissions, such as imperial cities hit by major fires. They often failed to resume paying the higher rates. Meanwhile, the Kreise developed their own registers to raise funds at the regional level. Although based on the 1521 imperial register, the Kreis rates often differed, offering further scope for unauthorized self-moderation as individual estates adjusted their payments to whichever rate was lowest. These problems were in fact common in old Europe, where taxes relied on registers assigning assessments only loosely correlated with actual wealth. Once compiled, such registers were hard to revise, not least thanks to the vested interest of those who were underassessed in resisting change. In fact, imperial political culture constrained self-moderation. Smaller estates were particularly reluctant to challenge the empire by unilaterally revising their quotas, and by the mid-18th century, many accepted that if they wanted a reduction, they would have to submit to a full investigation of their economic and financial circumstances by an imperial commission. Even combined with territories leaving the register through French annexation, like Metz, Toul, and Verdun, self-moderation only accounted for 15,900 florins, or a quarter of the losses by 1600. Twice that amount disappeared through the removal of minor estates listed in the 1521 register, which avoided payment by foregoing the status of imperial estate and accepting mediatization by another territory, such as the town of Lemgo, absorbed into the Principality of Lippe. All attempts to persuade the beneficiaries to make up the missing payments were abandoned by 1577, but at least fixing the status of imperial estate 5 years later entailed firm acceptance of the assigned burdens. The remaining quarter of the losses derived from the special status of the Austrian and Burgundian Kreiser, since these never remitted taxes through the imperial receiver. In fact, maintenance of the Habsburgs' imperial rule cost their own subjects far more than their official quotas. Maximilian I spent 25 million florins across his reign, mainly to recover Milan as an escheated imperial fief in the Italian Wars. Austrian taxes provided the Habsburgs with between 500,000 and 1 million florins a year, while the Netherlands contributed a further million annually from 1507. Despite these sums, assistance from the Empire was essential, and the 2 million florins voted for 1495 to 1518 represented an important additional source, even if only half the promised amount was actually paid. Significantly, Maximilian's 6 million florins of debt were contracted as Habsburg liabilities, reflecting his separation of Habsburg administration from that of the rest of the empire. Rather than seek amortization through the Reichstag, he and his successors chose to negotiate agreements with their provincial estates, who raised taxes from Habsburg subjects to pay the creditors. While this necessitated concessions to these assemblies, including religious toleration in the later 16th century, it freed the emperor from exposing his own finances to Reichstag scrutiny. More substantial assistance came in response to the rapid Ottoman advance through Serbia and Hungary after 1521, establishing a pattern persisting into the early 17th century. The Habsburgs petitioned each Reichstag for emergency aid to cope with the immediate threat, plus permanent aid on an extended basis to maintain frontier defenses in Hungary. Like other early modern European assemblies, the Reichstag initially refused the latter, recognizing that permanent tax grants would reduce the emperor's need to summon it again. Instead, it voted fixed grants, which could be drawn on as cash or troops until the allocated amount had been consumed. The total raised during Charles V's reign is difficult to calculate, because individual estates often paid after considerable delay, but overall, the imperial treasury had received around 4.3 million florins by 1555. Although far above what previous emperors had received, this amount still fell far short of Charles's burgeoning expenses. The 1544 grant provided only 3.7% of the emperor's war funding across 1543 to 1552, with the bulk raised largely from German and Netherlands bank loans. However, the seemingly meager amount reflected the division of labor within Habsburg governance and the empire's international orientation in the interests of peace. The Reichstag only assigned Charles half its 1544 grant, and even this was an exceptional case, because it did not feel obliged to back what it regarded as his private war with France. Instead, most imperial aid was directed to Ferdinand, who had been tasked with repelling the Ottomans. The actual scale of assistance was far greater than the official amounts, because it was largely provided as troops were raised, equipped, and maintained at the expense of the individual imperial estates. Ferdinand's administrative and financial reforms doubled the revenue he could extract from Austria, Bohemia, and his part of Hungary to reach about 2.2 million florins annually by 1560. Still far less than the average of 14.2 million that his brother had enjoyed from all his domains, including 6.9 million from the Burgundian lands. Ferdinand spent at least 530,000 florins on his court and administration annually, and between 540,000 and over 1 million on fortifying and defending the Hungarian frontier. His debts quintupled to 10 million florins by his death in 1564, excluding another 1.5 million of private debt. The three-way division of Habsburg lands between his sons after 1564 robbed them of any economies of scale, forcing each branch to trade concessions to their provincial estates in return for taxes, amortizing over 10.6 million florins of debts by 1615. Despite being a noted art patron, Rudolf II in fact cut court expenditure, channeling the savings into border defense. Yet despite the provincial estates doubling their tax grants, Habsburg debts tripled to 32 million florins by 1612, by which time annual revenue had reached only 5.4 million. This summary of the Habsburgs' deteriorating financial situation underscores the growing importance of aid from the empire across the second half of the 16th century. The 409 RMs voted for 1556 to 1603 represented well over five times the sums granted during Charles V's reign. Despite confessional tension, payment rates rose from around 70% at mid-century to 88% during the last quarter. Additional aid worth 7.5 million florins was secured by approaching the Kaiser directly during the Long Turkish War. Altogether, the Habsburgs received 31 million florins for the period 1556 to 1607, equivalent to 600,000 annually, adding considerably to regular revenue. The Reichstag was most generous during the Long Turkish War, but more than a quarter of the money was voted when there were no active hostilities against the Ottomans, thereby coming close to the Habsburgs' demand for permanent funding. Only the 1608 Reichstag closed without agreeing fresh assistance, while that voted in 1613, together with late payments from earlier grants, added another 2 million florins received across 1608 to 1631. Arrears totaled 5.3 million florins by 1619, but the regularity of grants before 1608 gave the Habsburgs better credit as emperors than as territorial rulers. The Reichspfennigmeister was able to raise an additional 3.8 million florins as anticipations against future imperial taxes, plus a further 1.9 million in long-term loans at only 5%, or way below the extortionate rates that bankers charged French and Spanish kings. The problem of arrears should also be set against the fact that several territories voluntarily paid extra contributions, which could be considerable. Such payments totaled 553,784 florins during 1592 to 1594. Above all, the system demonstrated the strength of the collective political culture. The Reichstag voted money for specific purposes, but its accounting system was restricted to recording how far individual imperial estates met their obligations, and it had no control over actual expenditure. Yet, despite their faults, the Habsburgs honored their promise to spend the money on defending Hungary from the Ottomans. It is against this background that the financial problems of the Thirty Years' War become clear. The controversy surrounding the Bohemian Revolt dissuaded Ferdinand II from summoning a Reichstag, relying instead on requesting support from the Kreis assemblies and individual imperial estates, especially the cities, some of which paid considerable sums. Cologne provided 82,830 florins for 1619 to 1631, equivalent to 110 RMs of its matricular quota. In an effort to lend these measures greater legitimacy, the emperor obtained the elector's agreement to a general levy of 96 RMs annually from 1630 to confront the Swedish invasion. A further 240 RMs were sanctioned this way for 1635 to 1638, before Ferdinand III finally recognized that Reichstag approval was essential if these measures were to stand any chance of acceptance, securing another 240 RMs in 1641. Direct approaches to the Christ assemblies covered the gap between 1638 and 1640. The payment rate fell far below what had been achieved in the late 16th century because the emperor was compelled to assign receipts from different regions directly to units of the imperial army in their vicinity. This eroded the already fragile distinction between official war taxes and the numerous other exactions imposed by commanders. Already in February 1638, the Franconians complained that these additional costs were 2 to 5 times what they owed in RMs and asked to offset further war taxes against what they were paying directly to the emperor's troops. Nonetheless, payments could still be significant. Official demands on the Archbishopric of Salzburg totaled 1,137 RMs across 1635 to 1648, of which 1,334,420 florins, or 64%, was paid. Given that these sums were far above previous taxes, and considering the conditions in which they were paid, this was simultaneously a remarkable achievement and a quantitative indication of the immense misery inflicted by the war. The real strength of the imperial fiscal system was demonstrated during 1648 to 1654, when it was used to raise the money to disband both sides' armies as agreed in the Peace of Westphalia. Despite 30 years of terrible war, 7 of the 10 Kreiser had paid 7.8 million florins to Sweden by 1654, as well as maintaining its army in the meantime at a cost of a further 20.5 million. The Bavarian Kreis raised 753,300 florins to pay off the Bavarian Elector's army, while Mainz, Cologne, and parts of the Westphalian Kreis raised 1.2 million to pay off Hessen Cassel's soldiers, as well as 375,000 to pay Spain in exchange for its return of the Frankenthal fortress in 1652. The emperor was promised 100 RMs to disband his troops. But other than his lands being exempted from the payments to Sweden and Bavaria, he received little, forcing the cost onto his own subjects. Altogether, the official fiscal structure raised about 30.25 million florins in just 6 years to disband around 170,000 soldiers and bring peace to the empire after 30 years of devastating warfare. The experience of the war rendered continuation of these methods politically impossible, as the imperial estates were no longer prepared simply to grant money without being able to control its expenditure. Instead, they returned to the methods employed in the 1520s of providing military contingents in lieu of tax. Any cash grants were now geared to supporting collective defense by providing money through a new imperial operations fund, Reichsoperationkasse, to pay the general staff, transport, and other centrally incurred costs, while the contingents were maintained directly by the territories that fielded them. The increasingly complementary distribution of functions across the empire's different levels saw growing fiscal activity through the Kreis assemblies, which raised additional sums, including for their own operations funds. The almost continual warfare between 1672 and 1714 led to these sums becoming virtually permanent additional taxes. Historians are only now grappling with the full scale of this activity, which is recorded in hundreds of account books scattered throughout Germany's numerous regional archives. The Upper Rhine Assembly voted 1,000 RMs across 1681 to 1714. Although the value of its Kreis RM declined from 8,900 florins, 1681, to 4,100 florins, 1704, The amounts were still substantial, especially considering the actual payment rate was about 90%. Indeed, payments received centrally by the Reichspfennigmeister, or the Imperial Operations Fund, give no indication of the true scale of the Empire's fiscal military effort, especially as most of the non-payment was often offset by much heavier expenditure incurred directly by the territories. Indeed, official grants became a way of leveraging more money from territorial subjects, since the Reichstag made payment of imperial taxes binding on all inhabitants in 1654. This is best illustrated by the War of the Spanish Succession, 1701-1714, which also saw the Empire's largest military effort after 1648. The central funds amounted to 9.1 million florins, of which about three quarters were paid, including this time also by the Habsburgs, who contributed 32% above their official assessment as a political gesture to encourage support for what was largely a war in their private interest. Additional voluntary contributions from the imperial knights, three Hanseatic cities, and some clergy netted a further 3.24 million florins. By contrast, Austrian military expenditure averaged 20 million annually. However, total expenditure was 650 million across 1701-1714, including the cost of the official contingents and additional auxiliaries provided by the imperial estates, as well as their other directly incurred war expenditure. Only 90 million of this was covered by subsidies from the Emperor's British and Dutch allies. The remainder was divided roughly one-third for the Habsburgs and two-thirds for the remaining imperial estates, indicating that the latter bore a disproportionately heavy burden. The Empire's overall effort exceeded Britain's military and naval expenditure by about 237.5 million florins. This effort was not matched subsequently, though the imperial estates still provided substantial financial and direct military aid during the wars against France and the Ottomans in the 1730s. No further Turkish aid was paid after 1740, reflecting the declining significance of the original imperial mission. The Reichstag voted 330 RMs to combat revolutionary France during 1793-1799, but the strained circumstances meant that only about 5 million florins, or around a third of the initial 230 RMs, were paid.